This week's podcast is sponsored by Orbital Marine Power Limited, the Scottish-based developers of the world's leading floating tidal turbine technology. The company recently launched the world's most powerful tidal turbine, the Orbital O2. Find out more at orbitalmarine.com. Welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. I'm Emily Boddy, Communications and Publications Officer at the SUT.
And I'm Andrew Connolly with the SUT Aberdeen Branch and SUT Council.
Each week we bring you interviews with our members, guests and colleagues from the global underwater technology community. Podcast 60, 3rd of June 2021. In this episode we talk with Oliver Ragg, Commercial Director at Orbital Marine Power Limited. Oliver talks about the development of their O2 tidal turbine, the world's most powerful tidal turbine, and how this can help in the path towards the goal of clean energy.
Welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast by the Society for Underwater Technology. My guest today is Oliver Ragg from Orbital Marine, and Oliver's based in London. Welcome, Oliver.
Hi, good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Oliver. Thanks for coming. So today we're going to learn about Orbital Marine and what they do. But before we go into that, Oliver, please tell us all a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. You know, thanks to yourself and the Society for Underwater Technology for inviting me on to give this podcast. So my background, you know, I've been working in the marine energy sector for the past 12 years now. I started off that career working for Renewable UK as the trade body, so engaging with UK government, which was DEC at the time, now obviously BEIS, looking at, you know, kind of renewables policy and what was required to support the sector at the time then. And after that, I moved on, worked for the tidal technology developer Atlantis, the guys who are building the Magium project and helped support some of the initial stages of the financing of the Magium project. And then moved on to the European Marine Energy Centre up in Orkney. I took on the role of commercial director at EMEC. When I joined, I had about 20 staff. And by the time I'd left, I think we were up to about 65 members of staff within the organisation. And the company then had diversified quite a bit, starting just working on wave and tidal, but then, you know, expanded into wave, tidal, floating offshore wind, energy systems, and also hydrogen. And so my role within that company was really looking at diversifying the business, bringing new clients in. I'd worked with probably all of the leading wave and tidal energy technology developers around the world at that point. If I'm honest, there were some that were good, maybe some not so good, in my opinion, from what we'd seen happen. But really, you know, one did stand out for me, and that was Orbital Marine Power. And I just really felt that the work that Orbital did with the SR2000 broke so many records in terms of power generation, uptime, ease of maintenance. I don't think the industry had ever seen anything like that before, from a first-off prototype to be so successful. I'd really kind of thought to myself, you know, look, here's the technology and here's the team. If anyone's going to make this a commercial reality, bearing in mind, you know, having worked in the sector for over a decade and unfortunately seeing more people fail than succeed, kind of reached the conclusion, it's like, okay, this is the company that's going to do this. I was very fortunate to be able to join Orbital Marine Power in April last year. And so my role at the moment as commercial director is looking forward at, you know, that commercialization of the technology, looking forward and saying, okay, where are we going with this? Where are we going to put future turbines? How are we going to help reduce the cost of energy? What governments can we support and can we work with? How does tidal energy fit within the wider transition towards net zero? But also, you know, how do we align with government policy and priority, build back greener, build back better mantra that we hear, not just in the UK, but globally? I suppose the core focus of what I'm looking at the moment, you know, with the O2 having just gone in the water now, you know, it's a really great time for us to be looking at where we can develop the technology, where we can go forward. Final word on myself is that from my experience, and as you said there, you're working for trade bodies and working for International Test Centre there, I've consistently seen Unfortunately, you know, many people overpromise and underdeliver, and so it's interesting for myself being on the other side of the table now, where I'm the person coming up with what some people might look as harebrained or crazy schemes. But what I'm very much trying to do, and what the company at Orbital is constantly doing, is looking to underpromise, overdeliver, make good on everything that we're coming forward. And so the commercialization strategy and the plan that we're putting forward is really building on the experience that I've had, seeing where others have succeeded or not succeeded in the past, and baking in a high degree of realism that we can actually achieve with the technology.
No, it sounds excellent. Marine energy is very much a sort of pioneering time over the last few years, and you've been involved in it on, as you say, both sides of the fence. So, you know, that's definitely going to be an interesting path to have taken, which, you know, sounds great. So, speaking about Orbital Marine, can you give us a bit of a background about the organisation?
Absolutely. Orbital Marine as a company has been at this longer than I have. It was incepted in the early 2000s, looking at how you solve the challenge of extracting commercially viable tidal energy. And that's the critical bit, you know, to think about how you make tidal energy commercially viable. Because you had a lot of people, you know, looking at this. And so the floating aspect and the ability to access the turbine nacelles is critical. Yeah, over that period of time, over the last 15 plus years, the company has taken a very staged, measured and careful approach and diligent approach to its technology development, which have seen the world's first floating grid-connected prototype, the SR250, installed at Ibeke in 2013. That then scaled up to the 2 megawatt SR2000, deployed again at EMEC in 2016. And now we're moving on to the O2, which is really the culmination of all that engineering experience to bring together a turbine and structured system. Again, it's a 2 megawatts of scale, but the important is rather than just trying to make a big technology jump and say, okay, we're going to go from 2 megawatts to 4 megawatts, it was refining and improving that 2 megawatt system to focus on those key levelized cost of energy metrics when you're looking at the operating costs, so how you can get and operate, access the machine, and maintain that high level of uptime.
So, yeah, you're talking about going from 2 megawatts to 4 megawatts. I mean, I guess you're talking about a doubling in energy production, but you're making things better to install, better to make, and more efficient as well. So does that represent quite a challenge of development?
It's definitely kind of a key focus and a key element within Orbital, is this constant need to kind of, you know, look and challenge, you know, how we've done things and how they can be made better. I mean, a key example was when you look at the evolution of the technology from the SR2000 to the O2, a lot of the elements of the SR2000 were right in terms of, you know, hydrodynamically how it worked. But one of the key issues that there was with that piece of technology and that design was that the turbine nacelles, the way that they came up, were underneath the hull. So even when the device was on station, if you had a problem or issue with the power takeoff, you couldn't access it at any point. And so that's something that we've rectified with the O2. The fundamental kind of principle that you look at here, and when you're looking at the importance of accessibility, when you look at bottom-mounted tidal or things that are hard to access, or what we would have had with the SR2000, you know, that was looking at some sort of design and maintenance program for the power takeoff that meant that you weren't accessing that for 5 years because of the cost of removing it from site, or if you have a bottom mounted device, you have a heavy lift vessel, or you've got to move it out, you've got to wait for different weather windows. You're actually designing something that is far more technologically advanced than we've seen in anything in offshore wind. You don't get offshore wind turbines where people design them so that you can't access for 5 years. You don't design for 5 year maintenance periods. You know, these wind turbines generally access every 6 to 12 months, even if it's just to change lubrication or something like this. And that's really, you know, one of the key things that we were looking at. And that's why, you know, you have this kind of what's become quite an iconic design with this kind of gull wing approach that we can see, which does draw several similarities between, I think I've heard, you know, a Star Wars X-Wing or someone saying, there was all sorts of other Star Trek analogies thrown out as well, but I have to confess, I'm not a Trekkie, I'm more of a Star Wars fan, so that one sticks with me more.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I definitely echo the X-Wing analogy. Yeah, I've seen various things about the O2 on social media and LinkedIn recently. So I think I've seen comments about X-Wings and whatnot. So, I mean, as you're saying, yeah, it's almost by design, you're putting something down into a very harsh environment because you're wanting to put something down in tidal zones where you can maximize the energy benefit. So, they say almost by design, it's going to be something that will ultimately need to be maintained regularly over its deployment life. So access is key.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just because it's such a critical part of levelized cost of energy. And it's also, I think, for the engineers, it's liberating in a way. I've heard stories of tidal turbines that have bottom-mounted ones that being installed and almost literally just retrieved straight away again because of the something very small that goes wrong and it doesn't get deployed because of the cost of the, you know, the heavy lift vessels that you see here. The engineering teams are doing that, the strain and the stress that they must be under, making sure that everything's perfect. It all has to work perfectly and then you just put it in the water and it's kind of fingers crossed. One of the, you know, really awesome things actually about the O2 is the commissioning program that the guys are undertaking at the moment. Up in Orkney. So we've got the machine in the water, so it floats, ticking the box there. We've got it up to towed from Dundee to Orkney, okay, nothing broke off there, ticking the box, okay, next challenge. So then what the guys have been doing, and it's just something I hadn't really appreciated when I was thinking about the staged approach that we have to this, is we're currently located in Deer Sound. So this is a far more benign and gentle area than where we're deploying the device in the Fall of Warness. And what's great about this is the guys have been able to get on, test all of the electrical systems in the water. We've been able to do the leg reps, you know, getting the nacelles up and down. So first we're doing that, we've done that kind of stationary. And then we've done that, you know, being towed by a multicat to simulate the tidal environment. So getting the legs up and down to do that. And I think at the beginning of the week, we actually mentioned that we ran the power takeoffs. You know, so the blades were actually spinning, I think we're up to 4 RPM, actually running electricity through all of the systems so that we could see, okay, look, yep, literally, and you couldn't get a more de-risked program than we've had for bringing this forward. So what's great about that is it means then when we get onto the site and as we're ramping up, we've got so much more confidence in how that's going to work.
So compared with, you know, you're talking about bottom-mounted turbines, is there a disadvantage to the amount of energy that you can harvest out of that? Or, you know, how does the O2 compare with other types of turbines that have been produced over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one to look at, Andrew, as well. I mean, first time you think there's basically a function of the tidal flow. So as you get to the resource at the bottom of the water column isn't as good as the top. So you have faster flow of water at the top of the water column because of the friction that you have on the seabed, and that slows the water movement down at the bottom. Mm. So the prime resource is at the top of the water column. It's a bit like in wind energy, you kind of have to punch through that turbulence barrier, you know, so that's what you use to get to a certain height to be able to access better wind resource, especially when you're onshore. And so it's a similar thing to that. Okay. So the whole design that we have is, you know, we're putting the turbines in the optimum location to maximise the resource. In terms of the, you know, how do we compare up to other turbines and so forth? It's a tidal generating platform at 2 MW. The O2 is the largest tidal turbine in the world as an individual generating station. There have been other developers that have tested 1 MW machines at EMIC and in other parts around the world. The turbines in the MayGen project, I understand they're about 1.5 megawatt drivetrains that they have on those machines. We are looking at the moment with our power takeoff, how we potentially scale that up to access different types of resource. But I also think, you know, with the rotor diameter at 20 meters, this is one of the largest swept areas. And so obviously the power that we're producing is a function of the amount of swept area that we have on the machine. So, you know, you've got 2 20-meter rotor diameter power takeoffs harnessing that energy. It really is an awesome feat of engineering.
That definitely sounds like it. Congratulations on having the most powerful marine turbine. For the offshore wind market, we hear about the key stakeholders being driven by European or Asian organisations, but it seems that there's a lot of development happening in the UK. And, you know, we were speaking with Rory Catapult recently as well in another podcast. And, you know, the UK has been a major hub for hydrocarbon energy and subsea technology. Do you think it can lead the way in tidal energy? You know, some of the work that you're doing and some of the, you know, the work that Rory Catapult are supporting with as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, where we are at the moment is it's not a case of, can the UK lead the way? The UK is leading the way. There is a hotbed of tidal energy innovation happening here at the moment through the likes of what we're doing, Orbital, and what some of the other tidal energy companies are doing across the UK as well. We're also blessed, you know, to have such fantastic tidal energy resource in the UK. There's up to practically extractable about 10 gigawatts of capacity in the UK. So, you know, we're talking about making potential significant contribution of predictable power into that transition to net zero. And so that's been recognised by, obviously, the technology developers, the investors behind those technologies to bring those forward. But what we're also seeing is a number of project locations and project sites that are moving forward and people investing in those. What's actually fantastic is that two projects that we're working closely with, so there's the PTEC project on the south coast of the Isle of Wight. So that's a 30 megawatt okay. project, which is being developed to host multiple technologies. And there's also the Morlaes demonstration zone off Anglesey. So that's a 240 megawatt project. What's great is that if we look at where we had wind energy, you know, where wind energy kind of came from and what marine energy has been forced to do up to this point, is that you create this technology and then you need to take it to market, but no one's investing in project development sites. So you need, as a technology developer, then you need to develop the sites as well. Your skill set is within technology development. It's not necessarily project development. So what you see is sometimes companies having to do both. And so I think there's a degree of that's healthy, and some, but there's sometimes that can take people away from the objective that they're trying to achieve at that point. So it's great to see people recognising that within the UK, and specifically, you know, various economic development agencies supporting the development of these projects to create that forward pipeline. Because again, the question is, so we're leading the world at the moment in tidal energy. Will we be leading the world in 10 years' time? Yeah, that's the critical bit as we commercialize this. And again, not being disparaging, but you do hear generally like the UK is very good at innovation. We're a bit weaker on the commercialization side and actually retaining that. And I think, you know, we've seen that from some of the government rhetoric around them wanting to see billion-dollar UK companies rather than innovation developed here, helping to create billion-dollar companies overseas. This route to market, so creating some of these project sites, that's great to land the supply chain and the manufacturing, because producing one prototype is one thing, but then scaling that up and producing tens, 50s, hundreds of machines, which is the trajectory that we want to get to, you need locations in which to deploy those. And so because that's coming through, that's a critical step in helping the UK secure that global lead in the future. But the other thing then is kind of if government support and bringing the UK government along that journey with us. I'm a member of a board of the UK Marine Energy Council. And so I sit on that. And so that's where we look at kind of the policy ask and the development and what's required from UK government to help us move on to the next steps and to bring the technology forward. And so one of the critical things we're looking at there is what's happening in the allocation round four of the contracts for difference process that BEIS has announced is going to be launched in December. And that's going to be really critical because some of the projects that we're looking at now have the potential, if the right mechanisms are created within that, so some dedicated support for tidal energy, that's the next critical step in securing that next part of the. Otherwise, as we've seen with some other technology developers, people start looking at overseas markets, which is great for export, and we do need to do that at some point. But right at the moment, my view is I want to see a UK-built tidal energy industry. And to do that, we need UK projects, which are coming online. We have UK technology, and we need UK government support to come along with that. All energy generation technology, when they start off, it starts off at this high price point. Yeah, there's innovation that drives down levelized cost of energy, but there's also economies of scale that drive this down. And we've seen this in solar, we've seen it in onshore wind, we've seen it in offshore wind. We've even seen it in the amount of state backing that you would have seen in the original boom in the North Sea oil and gas. Aberdeen is always held up as this world leader in oil and gas, and it's hard to find an oil and gas project around the world that doesn't have a Scotsman involved in it somewhere. And so we've got the opportunity to actually to do the same here for tidal energy. Offshore renewables as a whole, the UK is incredibly strong at. There's been a lot of talk around maybe there's not as much UK content as we'd like to see in some of these offshore wind farms, and there's a lot of drive from base to see that. We're ahead of the game here with tidal energy. Once the supply chain is located somewhere, it's really difficult to dislodge it, but the tidal energy supply chain is growing roots in the UK at the moment. To carry my analogy here, we just need to water those a bit more to make sure that it gets a bit more firmly rooted.
You're exactly right. The innovation is great, and you know the ability to do that is obviously clearly well placed in the UK, but it needs that nurturing to turn it into a wide-scale commercial success. And you're involved in those committees as well. That can be driven forward, and we can continue to be a global leader in marine energy. So you say the O2's up in Orkney at the moment, doing proving work. Where do you see that beyond, assuming the trials are successful, where do you see things going from there? Is it additional UK projects? Are you looking at wider global projects with it?
So there's a couple of things that we're looking at that we have in the pipeline at the moment. And again, reverting back to my original point that I was saying about you've got to have ambitious plans, but they've got to be baked in realism. And so where we're looking at is, you know, to have our first commercial array, so multiple machines of five or more devices, 10 megawatts plus sort of region. We'll be looking to have those in the water around about 2025. That's what we're hoping for. So we're hoping that UK CFD parameters are provided such that they support tidal energy sufficiently. By bidding into that process, we would then be able to draw down on revenue support, as any other project that puts into the CFD, in 2025. Now, some people may look at that and say, that's not very ambitious or optimistic. You know, how about we're in 2021 now, hang on, you're not saying that you're going to put an array, a commercial array in the water for another 4 years. I would turn around to other people and look at that and go, well, no, look, given the timeframes that we have, that's a realistic, achievable target. And if we set ourselves that, I am highly confident if we're given the right support framework from government that that can be delivered. You know, there's very few other things that I'd be worried about. The sites that we're looking at, they have grid connection, they've got consent, they've got development. They're highly de-risked projects. We have an O2 in the water that we'll be generating, we'll be producing power curves, we'll be able to provide that empirical evidence to incoming investors. The key mechanical components of the drivetrain, we're planning on not changing drastically between now and those turbines. Then the reason for that being is the need to produce that empirical evidence for incoming investors to look at those projects. There is plans for a deployment before then, though. It's not 100% confirmed yet. But we do have an additional berth at EMIC, which we have contracted. And the plan that we have there, whilst not a firm plan at the moment, so we're still working on this, but we hope that this will come to fruition, is to install a second machine next to the existing O2. And so we're kind of dubbing that O2.2, for lack of further imagination at the moment. And what's going to be really exciting and interesting about that is for the first time in the world, we'll have a floating array. This will have 4 megawatts installed. We'll be able to do additional environmental monitoring, additional monitoring on wake impacts and losses, look at the control systems further, and also importantly, de-risk a number of critical innovations that we see will be required to help reduce levelized cost of energy. Those innovations aren't necessarily around the power takeoff. They're around the kind of the structure, some things on moorings, anchors, connectors, some of these things that, you know, we can take this stepping stone approach to drive some more kind of critical innovation to deploy in 2023 that will then help us, again, further de-risk what we're putting in the water in 2025. And it's this progression of reducing risk over this time and reducing risk and reducing cost in parallel. And that's something that we think is going to be really important. You know, the proof is in the pudding, you know, that we need to provide evidence to incoming investors to support these projects, be that through equity in project companies or be that through debt that will help to leverage into some of these projects. I mean, we've had excellent success with crowdfunding, both in terms of equity raises and in terms of debt financing. So we raised £7 million for the O2. But, you know, we're going to be talking an order of magnitude larger for some of these array projects. So, you know, whilst we'd love to be able to go back to the crowd and offer some of those original investors the opportunity to invest in further projects, or in fact, other people who missed out on an opportunity to invest in future projects, you know, the sheer volume of finance that's going to be required means that that could be prohibitive there. Longer term, what does that look like? I mean, we are completing feasibility work, looking in other areas, specifically looking in Canada, looking in the US, looking around in Indonesia, South Korea, Australia, Japan, just to give you a short list of locations there. Tidal energy resource around the world is fairly well mapped. So we have a longer lead list of locations that we're looking for. But the longer term bit, and where do we go with this in our global outlook, is kind of summarized by this horizon that we're looking at the moment, which is technology in the water, innovation and economies of scale for cost reduction in the 2020s, which will, as I said, cost curve, we need to come down. They're going to be more expensive projects. And so that's identifying where we tie in with government strategies and requirements, or where we can identify projects with higher energy costs than we have at the moment. And so that objective is to get 200 megawatts in the water. We're working with third-party consultants, Black & Veatch, who have produced independently verified and incredibly detailed levelized cost of energy model. You know, looking at all these various innovations, looking at upweighted economies of scale, cost reduction. In a nutshell, by getting 200 megawatts in the water this decade, moving into the 2030s, that puts us in the projects that we'd be looking at a cost cheaper than nuclear in the UK, which is a kind of a sub £90 a megawatt hour price. And at that price, we believe actually much bigger projects can be rolled out potentially without the need for such high levels of government intervention. And it's really over the 2030s where globally tidal energy is starting to have an impact into the transition towards net zero, you know, and removing that. And so that's the from the very kind of cautiously optimistic approach over the first 5 year periods to get everything right, that's the bigger vision and the bigger objective that we want to get to. One last thing I'll just point towards as well, in terms of globally how this kind of looks and what we're doing, and coming back to that 4 megawatt array and how important that is in our strategy and our plans. And the reason that we want to take that to EMEC is because onshore, EMEC have got a really interesting microgrid system that they're developing there and is being worked on literally at the moment. I know a couple of the engineers haven't left the island of Ide for quite a few months working on the site, developing this. I think a couple of them, as reports go, really enjoying it, as they say, so to have got out from behind the desk. But you've got a grid connection that goes into the national grid, but you've also got what's being built at the moment is a redox flow cell battery, and that's going to be connected to two separate electrolyzers to produce green hydrogen. So, you know, you talk a lot about the energy system of the future and how this all kind of varies and transitions, and having variable tidal power, being able to dispatch that to the grid or store it in batteries and either dispatch it to the grid later or store it in the battery and then produce green hydrogen that can then get used for other applications, for marine transport or shipping or clean aviation or something like this. You know, there's loads of other applications for it. That starts to become really interesting. And from a green hydrogen perspective, I always look at that and say, okay, what you're doing is you're harnessing that natural resource of the tide, and then you're storing it in either a liquid or a gas. That becomes really interesting and really exciting for some of these really big tidal energy resources that we have around the world, like in the north of Australia. There's huge tidal resource there, but there's very little local demand for that. But what you also have in you know, say, North Australia, is you've got large established oil and gas export infrastructure. People have looked at this, and there's an existing economy, supply chain, trade routes that you have there. And it's kind of this interesting shift that could happen. I mean, and I appreciate where we are at the moment with a 2 megawatt machine in the water, to then jump to this to go, okay, there's some really big mega projects here. But the point is, if you have this, you have tidal energy resource, it's like sitting on top of a oil and gas field. All you need to do is harness that, and then you export that. And so with the tidal resource, you need to harness the tidal resource, produce the electricity, and then convert that into the hydrogen that then can either be put into as a gas or as ammonia or liquefied organic hydrogen carrier, some other means on that then can get distributed and shipped around the world as a global commodity. We've even already seen Germany come out quite publicly and say, yeah, we're going to need to buy wholesale large amounts of green hydrogen in the future. That's the strategy they have, because they've recognised they do not have the indigenous renewable resources to power their economy. So this is a really interesting shift that we can see. And whilst obviously a 4 megawatt project is small bear in that bigger picture, you know, that I'm painting here, it's a really important first step, because it will be a fantastic proof of concept.
It's a tremendous vision to have, and it's the right vision to have. Getting something right now and being able to commercialize that and have, you know, constant improvement and making it easier to build and ultimately reducing that cost of energy is going to be key. And as you say, this path to producing green hydrogen has to be very important over the coming years. You know, grey hydrogen, blue hydrogen is all interesting stuff, but the net zero goal is absolutely going to come from when we can do green hydrogen efficiently and cost effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And the really interesting thing with net zero is, you know, I always think about this, it's like there's no room to hide. No, there's like zero. It literally is in the term, it's net zero. There's zero tolerance here. There's a lot of hype about hydrogen at the moment. I think within the energy system as a whole, it's going to take a while to work out where the right applications are for it. I don't in any way think that it's the be-all and end-all for everything, but just the amount of energy storage that there is in the UK gas network alone, I don't have the numbers at the top of my head, but you would need inordinate sizes of giga battery storage facilities to equate to that. So it's going to be difficult to envisage an energy system of the future that doesn't include some form of energy that's stored within liquids and gases.
I don't think that batteries are the full answer to all the sort of electrified society that we're going to have, purely for the fact of the need to mine the materials for the batteries. But that's a very big conversation to have another day, I think. It's really all very interesting, Oliver. I mean, thanks for sharing. And I think tidal marine energy has to play a big part in it, as you say, the amount of energy that can be harvested there and the predictability of it compared with wind, which, albeit up here in Scotland, it gets very windy, but the predictability of marine and tidal energy has to play a big part of it over the coming years. So people speak about environmental concerns, about things like bird strikes on wind turbines. Is there an equivalent issue for tidal turbines?
Yeah, I mean, again, Andrew, you know, it's an important question and something that is always within the kind of the public's natural psyche to worry about these sort of things. You know, I'm not going to repeat the sorts of words that people do anecdotally, you know, say tidal turbines will be, but, you know, bits of sushi on the other end and so on and so forth are often things that are thrown out as quips with this. Yeah, and it was raised, yeah, rightly so, as one of the first questions that came back to us through the Crowdcube process when we were reaching out to public investors at the time. At the end of last year. The main thing to take away of this, you know, there's been extensive environmental monitoring of all orbital technology that's gone in to date. At the European Marine Energy Centre, you have probably the most robust environmental monitoring programme that's been completed anywhere in the world. That's supplemented with, you know, incredibly detailed environmental monitoring at the Magian project, and then also from other deployments that we've seen around the UK. To date, nothing has come back with a negative environmental impact here. We're getting a clean bill of health from this. The things that people are most worried about is impact with cetaceans, so seals, porpoise, and so forth. I know in other areas, in other parts, you know, people are worried about interaction with orca. What we're really seeing is, you know, look, yeah, and even with fish, these are intelligent animals that in their natural environment, they don't go around just bashing into the bottom of boats or bashing into rocks. And the point is that tidal turbine blades are not moving that quickly. Water is 800 times denser than air, which means actually we don't need the same level of RPM and rotations, you know, to extract the same amount of energy from the tidal resource. So, you know, we've not seen any negative impacts from that. There's been some studies that have been done looking at where the turbines are in the tide. They create some additional turbulence behind them. That's seen kind of increased amounts of bird activity for fishing. So that stirs up kind of more feed for them and so forth. You know, it's silly things like we've got footage of birds using the SR2000 when it was deployed at EMIC as a roosting area. So we'd regularly see birds stopping and then going and feeding and then coming back, which is okay to an extent. Obviously, we're not creating an offshore birdhouse. But, you know, these sorts of things, like, I know it sounds like a quick, but it's not making it, you know, negative, we're not seeing a huge negative environmental impact. I try very hard not to draw comparisons from other sectors and what negative impacts they may be having on the environment. But, you know, to go to wind turbines and bird strikes, the number of birds that are killed in the UK by wind turbines is a fraction of a percentage in comparison to the number of birds that are killed in the UK from domestic cats.
Okay.
It's a fraction of a percent.
Well, I mean, hopefully the bill of health continues to be clean, you know, and I'm sure there's plenty of eyes cast over it, but sounds all good so far, which is great.
And we're very hopeful that with the 4 megawatt array that we put in, we'll be instigating, again, one of the most robust environmental monitoring programs that I think the tidal energy industry will have ever seen.
Really been interesting learning about the O2 turbine and the work that Orbital Marine are doing at the moment, and I really wish you all the success with the deployment up in Orkney at the moment. So thanks for sharing some information with us all. At least we say if anyone wants to find out more about O2 or Orbital Marine, how do they go about doing that?
One of the best ways to do that is to follow Orbital on social media. The social media game is strong. I would say we're on LinkedIn, Facebook and Twitter. Obviously, the website is an easy go-to point. And there's actually some really great videos on YouTube as well. So if you check that out, it's not just the O2 technology, but there's some really interesting points around the people behind the technology. This is an endeavor that has been put together by a group of people who are highly passionate about turning the tide on climate change, and understanding their individual stories, motivations behind that. Yeah, it's great to go and check those out as well.
We'll include details of links to websites, and we can include YouTube links as well in the podcast description. So audience, please take a look there for links to information. That leaves me with our recurring feature of Subsea Facts. You've had various experience around the subsea world, and well, especially in marine energy. Have you got anything interesting or unusual as a fact that you can share with us?
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. I've got a couple of key things that I can share with people. So one thing about the O2 that's an interesting fact is that the turbine itself is incredibly similar to the dimensions of a 747. If the listeners can cast their mind back to what it was like being in an airport, yeah, you're looking out on the runway, and if you're looking at a 747, you look at that, you can imagine the O2 is the same size of that. It just gives you a perspective of the feat of the scale of engineering that's behind that. My other subsea fact is taken from my previous work life, where I worked in fisheries science. This is something that I didn't know until I had this job as a fisheries scientist, where I'd spend time in labs and I'd go offshore and do fisheries surveys. But you can tell the place of the sexual cycle of a fish, male or female, by giving their tummy a little rub underneath. And depending how they react to it, you can tell which of their 7 stages they're at in their sexual cycle.
Okay.
Not much to do with tidal energy, but there you go. Interesting fact, nevertheless.
Well, no, that's a really interesting subsea fact. A very unusual subsea fact as well. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, and there's bone in the ear of the fish that has rings that you can tell the age of the fish by as well, by counting it like the rings of a tree.
All right, okay, yeah, excellent.
This could be a whole different podcast.
We could have a whole different podcast on aspects of fish. I wasn't quite sure what to expect from the scale of the O2. I follow you guys now on LinkedIn too, and I see various pictures of it. I see pictures of people standing on the deck of it as well. And I wasn't quite expecting that it was the size of a 747. So that's quite an impressive scale. Would you think about recycling old 747s to build tidal turbines out of them?
That's an interesting one. I'll definitely flag up with the team. you know, if it was a piece of paper, that I've written to them, they might look at that very quickly and scrunch it up and put it in the bin. But you know, I can.
That might be filed in a special place.
It could be filed in a special place. There, yeah, definitely. But we can, you know, who knows? You know, reduce, reuse, recycle.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, thanks very much, Oliver, for a really interesting bit of background and information on the O2 turbine. It's really been fascinating to learn. And as I say, I wish you guys all the success over the coming years.
That's fantastic, Andrew. And you know, thanks to yourself and the SUT for having me on and your interest in the orbital technology.
Thank you. And thanks to the audience for tuning in to the podcast. Do tune in to us again and look forward to having you with us.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. To find out more about SUT, go to sut.org. If you'd like to get in touch with us about appearing on a future episode, or to find out how you can sponsor an upcoming episode, contact info@sut.org. You can also follow SUT on social media. We're on Twitter @SUT_news, Instagram @Society for Underwater, Facebook @Society for Underwater Technology, and LinkedIn @SUT-Society for Underwater Technology. Please don't forget to like, rate and subscribe to the podcast, and we'll be back with a new episode next week. Thank you again to this week's podcast sponsors, Orbital Marine Power Limited, the Scottish-based developers of the world's leading floating tidal turbine technology. The company recently launched the world's most powerful tidal turbine, the Orbital O2. Find out more at orbitalmarine.com.